Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Charlie Garvin, and it's my distinct pleasure tonight to introduce Guy Kawasaki, Managing Director of Garage Technology Ventures and author, most recently, of Reality Check, The Irreverent Guide to Outsmarting, Outmanaging, and Outmarketing Your Competition. For nearly 30 years now, Guy has earned a notable and provocative reputation as an entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and most recently, blogger. He first made his mark at Apple Computers, where he was instrumental in the success of the Macintosh computer and refined the concept of product evangelism. After spending several years as an Apple fellow, Guy left the company and co-founded Garage Technology Ventures, an early-stage venture capital firm specializing in high-tech startup companies. Currently, he writes one of the most popular blogs in the world and is a regular columnist for Entrepreneur Magazine and Forbes.com. The author of 9 books, including The Art of Start and Selling the Dream, Guy also recently co-founded Alltop.com, Alltop.com, an online magazine rack of popular topics on the web. Our moderator for this evening will be Tom Verton, Western Regional Manager at Silicon Valley Bank. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Guy Kawasaki and Tom Verton.
Well, Guy, I'm delighted to have this opportunity to sit and ask you some questions tonight.
Well, you know, first, I was just doing the math. There's no way I was doing this 30 years. Because that would imply I started in 1978 and I was still in school in 78.
Oh, well, 28, is that more accurate?
Well, still, it's not 30.
I tell you what, since you have a with all the books that you've written and all the talks that you've given and the speeches and whatnot, you've left quite a trail. So but I wanted to start with a little bit of history. I want to go back to Apple, and I want to ask you what your best experience at Apple Computer was.
Well, you mean in a single event or the totality?
You know, I'll give you a license.
Well, I worked for the Macintosh division from 1983 to 1987, and those were what I call the wonder years, as in, I wonder how I'm getting paid to do something that's so much fun. It was essentially, you know, at the end of a Super Bowl where they find the winning quarterback and it's been a long time since we've been to a Super Bowl. It's kind of hard to remember this, but they go to the winning quarterback and the guy says, you know, I'm going to Disneyland. Well, working in the Mac division was like being paid to go to Disneyland every day. And it was such a wonderful experience. We were changing the world, at least we thought we were. And we worked for Steve Jobs himself. Very special treatment because we worked for Steve Jobs and we were on this mission and life was good. I hope everybody in their career has, you know, one chance to work for something that had such impact in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. What was the one or two things that you learned from Steve that you brought forward in your career?
I can give you some anti-lessons, too. I think the lesson that I learned from Steve in particular was an appreciation for user interface and design. And no one who worked in the Macintosh division could possibly have worked there and left without an appreciation for elegance. And to this day, it absolutely befuddles me that companies with seemingly unlimited resources either do not have the smartness or do not have the taste to design better products. It just flabbergasts me that I look at some of these digital cameras and some of these computers from multi-billion-dollar corporations, and I just say to myself, you know, did they hire all the people who were fired from Volvo to design that? I mean, why is that? Was there some engineering spec that said this has to be ugly? I just don't understand that.
What about as regards leadership principles? Did you learn anything particular from Steve Jobs, Guy?
Well, he has a very interesting leadership style, shall I say. And it's not a style that I particularly embrace. He's very demanding. He's often, shall I say, excessively truthful. And it's just not my style. He does get the best out of you, I think, because people fear him. And, it works for him. Clearly it works for him, but it's not something that, I've emulated in my career. But can't knock his success. Can I swear on a Churchill Club thing?
Well, you did the last time you were
not
on.
Not Churchill. Jeez, I'm like, it shows maybe it is 30 years. I said Churchill Club. Oh, my God, it's Commonwealth Club.
Commonwealth,
my
yes.
God. Can we, erase that? Can we just backtrack?
I'm sure they'll work on it
in our
absence.
Wow.
Let me ask you about Wozniak. You interviewed on Commonwealth Club Wozniak
sure
a while
Commonwealth,
back.
Right?
Yeah. So was there anything special you learned from Wozniak?
Well, Wozniak is a completely different case. Look, Wozniak is the purest form of engineering I've ever met. And he just loves cool stuff. And he may be, in terms of chronological age, he may be 50 or 54 or whatever he is, but mentally he's about 16. And I say that as a positive. So he has this childlike fascination with cool stuff. And in that sense, they were a great balance because you need this engineering nerd who loves cool stuff. And his biggest challenge was to take the entire disk drive controller and stick it on one chip just because nobody had done it before. And then you need the Steve Jobs salesperson, hustler, marketer, evangelist to complement that. If they were both like Steve, they would never ship. And if they were both like Woz, they would never sell. But the two together, quite a potent package.
So one more question about Wozniak and Steve Jobs. What did they learn from you? What do you think they took away from their experience of working with you?
They didn't learn jack from me. Even in my most egotistical moments, I don't think... This is a rare moment of Guy Kawasaki humility, but let me tell you... I think if you asked Steve Jobs, what'd you learn from Guy, he would laugh. And rightfully so. I don't think he learned anything from me. He already likes sushi. I don't know.
All right, so let me fast forward a little bit.
Who asked that question?
if you were still at Apple, if you were at Apple today, and you were perhaps at the helm of Apple, what would you be pursuing?
Retirement. I love Apple. To this day, I truly love Apple. And I use Macintoshes. I have an iPhone. Our house has 5 or 6 Macs, something like that. We have more iPods than people in our house. We have iPods just laying around. It's like in an ashtrays. People give me iPods. People give me pitches on brand new iTouches just so that they, they think they guilt me into looking at it, which actually is true because if somebody gives you an iTouch, you should at least look at the, So we have tons of that kind of stuff. Don't you have an easy question?
I got an easy one for you. This is taken out of, I think your current book and maybe your speech at Babson.
Okay.
Joy is the right goal of entrepreneurship. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, I actually said that joy is the right goal of life. I'm 54 years old now, and I used to think that the goal of life is to be happy. And happiness implies a steady state of happiness where you have, the German car, the Swiss watch, the golf membership. You have a home in Montana, and you have one in Woodside. And, you stay at the Ritz-Carlton for your corporate offsites and all that kind of good stuff. It implies perfect health, perfect children. Your children are going to the finest private schools. And, of course, they're trying to pick between Harvard and Stanford. And you have a private plane. And that sort of implies this, happiness thing. I have come to find out that life is truly not steady-state happiness. and that the best you can hope for is episodes of joy. And so for me, the episodes of joy include my children. They bring me joy every day, but not every child brings me joy every day. I have four children, so the probability is at any given point, one of them brings me joy. There's no such thing as happy. Okay, so my children bring me great joy. My wife brings me great joy. And playing hockey brings me great joy if and when I ever score. And starting a company like Alltop brings me great joy. But between that joy, I'm dealing with various health issues. I'm dealing with, you know, migraine headaches. I'm dealing with driving a old Sienna. I mean, so I think when you're young, you think that, you know, the goal is just steady state happiness. And as you get older, you figure out, wow, you get this joyous day and this pit, joyous day and this pit. And as long as you have some joyous periods, but you have to pick what makes you joyful, right? So if it's joyful to buy a 5,000 square foot house, you know, it's much harder to do that than to just score a goal in hockey. So that's kind of my hindsight, and I really, that quote should be applied to life, not just career.
Well, let me ask you another question regarding your values. So what values drive the investment choices that you make? When you look at a company, are there some altruism as part of your investment choice?
You kidding me? You're asking a VC if there's altruism when I well, surely you jest.
I'm asking Guy Kawasaki.
Well, no, but, you know, when you ask someone to open up a checking account at Silicon Valley Bank, are you thinking altruism or are you thinking spread on the interest?
Here's something else that you said. So, let's give you a little background to that question. So here's
you know, if you look back through everything I've said, you will find contradictions. I hope you know that.
You said, obey the absolutes. There absolutely are absolute rights and wrongs.
Okay. I said that.
So that to
this
me
is the problem with the internet. You know, everything I said is coming back to haunt me. Jeez. I said that. I said that in a speech. I said that because I believe that there are some things that are absolutely correct and absolutely right. And it seems to me that, you know, when you're young, that the world is sort of absolute. You know, you can or cannot. You should or should not. But as you get older, you sort of get that very bright and obvious line between right and wrong gets fuzzy. And you start doing things like, well, my colleagues in the company, I know that they're going on these junkets that are not deductible or they're not expensible, but they're expensing it. I know they're doing that, right? So they're doing that, so, you know, what's wrong if I do that a few times too? And it becomes a period where it's a very slippery slope, and I think that there are absolute rights and wrongs, that you cannot cross that line. And, you know, when you look at things like, sometimes you cross it so badly, you have to ask, are these people just stupid? All right, so, you know, when you turn on CNN and you see that AIG is having an off-site, and, you know, the CEO has like a, you know, this $5,000 a day hotel suite, and they're doing all this kind of stuff, and then there's toga parties, and you ask yourself, what are these people thinking? Like, how could they possibly think that? Although, and so they have made some calculation that either it's okay because we were going to go to the, you know, an expensive hotel in the south of Spain, and we're only doing it in the south of Florida, so we've just saved the company a bunch of money, so it's okay to take a luxury suite. I mean, I don't understand that. And it befuddles me what gets into people's brains to think they can get away with that.
Well, let me change the subject on you now and ask you, if Obama asked you to be his chief technology officer...
Yeah.
How would...
How do you know I didn't vote for McCain?
Yeah, well...
I didn't.
It's not...
Well, just the setting question, the record straight.
The question really
I also
goes
voted
to,
no on eight, all right, just so you know.
The question really goes to how would you advise Obama to use technology in the presidency for his first and second term? What would you do?
Well, I don't know. Well, my father was a state senator, so I grew up in a political family. I have a distaste for politics. And I don't know what, quote unquote, the chief technology officer of the United States would truly do. I mean, I guess he could standardize the country on Macintoshes. You know, that would be cool. He could declare that no Canadian phones come into the United States, so there goes BlackBerry. I guess that would be my first two actions.
How could he use social networking?
Wait, I didn't answer that question. So I'm still thinking about the Obama question. So, you know, so what does Obama need? So Obama's going to say to his CTO, well, you know, what should we do about spectrum licensing? Or do you think that Twitter should charge for access? Or do you think AOL should be split up? Or do you think we should go with 802.11a or g? I mean, what does a CTO of the United States do? Maybe the one piece of tangible advice I would give, this is very frustrating. I'm not that concerned about what any politician could do to entrepreneurship. I don't think even in their most powerful state they could really screw up the entrepreneurial spirit. Okay? No matter what tax thing. You know, Joe the plumber is not going to be a plumber because Obama has a higher tax scheme. Well, Joe the plumber could first get a license and he could pay his back taxes. Then let's talk about higher taxes. Right? Let's make sure that Joe the plumber can fix the pipe. That would be a good start. So I think one thing that would be wonderful for entrepreneurship, forget the capital gains tax and all that, is we should just open up immigration and like anybody from any other country in the world wants to come here and live, well, I guess other than, you know, Osama bin Laden, let them come in, because it seems to me that what we need in this country is people who are hungry and want to make a difference and be a success. And if a third or fourth generation American has lost that edge, hallelujah. You know, let all the people from India and Croatia and all that, let them all come in. First generation, they'll run service stations in 7-Elevens, right? Then they'll, like, kill themselves and they'll send their kids to universities. And those kids will be in the universities and their parents are struggling and putting them through the university. They're going to get a computer science degree and they're going to create this next great tech startup, right? Meanwhile, you know, if you're fifth-generation American and you're a trust fund baby and you're going to go to Princeton because your father went to Princeton and his father went to Princeton, like, big deal. What's that person going to do? Yeah. Good point. So I don't believe in protectionism. I don't believe that, you know, we should limit the visas so that jobs are lost to Americans. Man, if India wants to send us their best and brightest programmers, man, I would just open the door. Hallelujah. Come on down. I'll just suck all the brains out of the world. That would be my policy. Suck brains. So, I don't really know the demographics or political orientation of the Commonwealth Club, so I don't, you know. Am I supposed to be Democrat, Republican, or Libertarian? I don't, you know, I am what I am, I guess.
So, do you think the doom and gloom outlook by Sequoia Capital is overstated or self-serving?
Well, I don't see how it can be self-serving because Sequoia Capital is infinite money. The people at Sequoia, you know, time and again has picked winners. So that scary presentation, I don't know, it was a good slap in the face. It's a good lesson. I think entrepreneurs should assume at this point that whatever money they've raised, that's the last money they'll ever raise. I think that's a good assumption. If you operated your business that way, you'd be much, much better off than to think that, you know, venture capital is like crack, right? And you don't really want to be addicted. So in a sense, the crack dealer was telling you, hey, crack is drying up. That's a good thing. That's a lot better than saying, well, crack will always be plentiful, so don't worry, just keep smoking it. I think that was a good thing. It just shook people up, and why not? And, you know, the beauty of this, in a sense, venture capital is in the toughest position it's ever been because of open source and MySQL and PHP and Rails and all this other kind of stuff. For 50 or 100 grand, you can really do some great stuff these days. And before, you'd have to pay 100 grand just for Oracle's, you know, database license, right? So, wow, life is much better. So, in a sense, it's cheaper to start a startup than ever. And there's also less money than ever, which is okay. I'm not nearly as pessimistic. I think one of the things that entrepreneurs could do today in this so-called recession is just plug their ears and keep going. That would be my recommendation.
In your book, you state, things are never as good or as bad as they seem. Can you elaborate, especially in regards to the current economic
environment? Well, I specifically said that about Apple, that at Apple, things are never as good or as bad as they seem. And I've been there in very bad times inside of Apple when it was bad, and it really wasn't that bad. You know, at that point, they had billions in cash. Their market share was falling down, but you know, there was never any real threat that Apple would die. Now Apple's on top of the world, and I would make the case that probably it's not as good, it's not as infallible, and it's not as, you know, totally independent of the recession and everything else. That quote was specifically about Apple, but I've also come to believe that, you know, that may be true of life. It's amazing. I've had a fortunate life, but you know, from the outside looking in, you may think I've had a wonderful life. But you know, I've had my periods of ups and downs. But I also know that, you know, looking at other people's lives, I'm very lucky. So I think that's a good saying for life, actually. But I specifically mentioned that about Apple. So you know, don't go too long on Apple right now.
What are some of the key future technologies that you think will drive Silicon Valley in the future?
I have no idea. In a second moment, this is a real historic moment. Second time I'm modest tonight. I'm not a visionary. I'm not a visionary. I'm not an engineer. I'm just a marketing guy. And I hope that I have the ability that when I see the future, I will recognize it. But I cannot create the future. Steve Jobs can do that. Other people can do that. I cannot do that. I'm merely a marketing person. So, you know, asking me that question is, it impugns your intelligence. How's that?
All right. Well, let's, Guy, thank you for the comment. Yeah. Let's talk about social networking. For the baby boomers that aren't engaged in social networking, what are they missing out on? How would you advise them?
Well, social networking, specifically Facebook, MySpace, and Twitter, and those kind of things. I use only one of those three things. I only use Twitter. I can't be bothered with Facebook because it's too inefficient. The fact that somebody posted something on my wall is like, you know, I am not going to go take out 5 minutes to go look at my wall on Facebook. And Facebook email is point to point, and you have to be inside of Facebook to answer a Facebook email. I cannot do that. I need a client that can suck in email from all these addresses. MySpace, funny you should mention that. I just got this email notice that said, if you don't go visit your MySpace account, we're going to give away the domain, because I guess there's lots of Guy Kawasaki's who want this domain. So the first thing I did when I got that email is I sent it to my IT buddy. I said, is this a scam or not? Because, you know, you get these things that PayPal, somebody's changing your account, and B of A is changing your account, and, you know, all these things. So who knows if that's real? So he said that's real. So I went back to MySpace, and I signed in for once again. And then I guess like 10 years from now, they'll ask me if I, you know, still want MySpace. So the question was, what are you missing? I think you're missing a great deal of, I have made literally thousands of friends online. Now, you might ask, how do you define a friend? but I have had relationships, and I have, not sexual, but I have had relationships, and I have had, I truly do believe that I could put a message up in Twitter saying that I'm going to Istanbul in 3 days, and would you like to have a little group meeting of people on Twitter in Istanbul? And there would be 20 people there. And I could say that, and I could say that about any city in the world, and it's because of Twitter. It's because of my social network or those social networks. So I think it broadens your mind to be on social networks because you meet people from all over the world that are not confined by cost of communication, the time zones. You know, imagine if you could only talk to people. And you're, you know, how would you talk to someone in Istanbul conveniently? Because when they're asleep, you're awake and vice versa. So I think it's a wonderful broadening experience to be on a social network.
Thank you. Do you have any advice for an MBA student who is looking to work for a VC?
Yeah, don't. I think that you should become a venture capitalist at the end of your career. It should be the last or second to the last job in your career, all right? And so the concept of getting an undergraduate degree, then going and getting an MBA in finance, and then going to work for a venture capital firm so that you can be a venture capitalist is deeply flawed. It's deeply flawed because a good venture capitalist is someone who can truly advise an entrepreneur on what to do, not how to crank a spreadsheet. Because in reality, you spend very little time in the real world cranking a spreadsheet. You just need to know that, you know, if you sell it for $100 and you know it cost you 20, you made $80. That's about the math you need to know, right? And so if you get this MBA and then you go into a VC firm as an associate and you crank spreadsheets and you suck up to the partner and you fly on the private plane and you got your BlackBerry, he's got his BlackBerry, you sit in the board meetings, you appear to be intelligent and listening for 2 hours a month per company. You know, what the hell do you truly learn? And so a good VC should be able to advise an entrepreneur about what to do. And I don't see how an MBA who became a VC will ever be able to truly advise an entrepreneur. So a good test, in my blog I have something called the VCAT, which is the Venture Capitalist Aptitude Test. And it has things like if you would be qualified to be a VC if you've done things like recruited somebody. How many venture capital associates have ever recruited somebody? How about fired somebody? How about laid somebody off to look somebody in the eye and say, you know, I screwed up, there's not enough money, but I'm here and you're gone. How many VCs have done that? How many VCs have introduced the product? How many VCs have introduced a product with no marketing budget? How many VCs know how to suck up to Michael Arrington to get him to cover your product in TechCrunch? How many VCs know who Michael Arrington is? So until you have the ability to, you know, contact Michael Arrington and get your product mentioned in TechCrunch, or call up Chris Shipley and get your product into demo, or to be able to call up David Pogue or Walt Mossberg because, you know, you worked with David Pogue when he was a Macintosh guy or something like that. And then you laid off people, you fired people, you've hired people, you've actually gone through a beta test, so you kind of know that whatever the engineers tell you, you should double for the length of the beta test. Unless you've done all that stuff, and unless you've seen that, oh, yeah, so, you know, everybody comes into a VC saying that they have really high quality content. And it's so high quality, and advertisers are dying for this demographic. And so we're, conservatively speaking, we should get $10 CPM. That's what every entrepreneur in Web 2.0 says. We're going to get $10 CPM. A venture capitalist needs to know that you're smoking dope. You're going to get 25-cent CPM. And until you have all that kind of background and you've been bashed around and you've laid off and been laid off and all that and you've just been kicked in the teeth, I don't think you can be a good VC. So that's a very long answer to why you should not go from MBA school to venture capitalist to think you're going to be a great venture capitalist. Nor should you go to an investment bank, right? Because if they're hiring. Because if you go to an investment bank, you know, it's somewhat the same thing, right? So, you know, people are sucking up to you. You're flying around in private planes. And it's not the real world. You know, what investment banker has ever introduced a product? Zero.
So, Guy, what kind of investments are you seeking for your fund?
Our Garage Technology is an early stage venture capital firm. That's why we're called Garage, not Mezzanine, you know, Technology Fund. And so we're looking for two guys or two gals or a gal and a guy in a garage who are probably unproven, with an unproven business model, with an unproven technology, who are trying to change the world. And we specifically don't do biotech and medical devices because we'd like to get rich in this lifetime. And we don't think we are a small $20 million fund. We cannot handle, you know, this kind of $50 million to break even semiconductor or enterprise software thing. We need companies that can break even at $2 to $3, $4, $5 million ever invested. That's West Coast. West Coast being defined as Denver to Honolulu, to San Diego, to Seattle.
So you've written 9 books and have an extremely busy blog.
Yeah.
How do you determine your topics, and are the audiences you are targeting for each different?
Oh, if you're giving me way too much credit. I'll tell you how I blog. The way I blog is this. Let's say I just posted something. And then about 3 days later, I'm saying to myself, oh, God, you haven't posted anything for 3 days. And people are going to say you're losing your edge and you have nothing to say. You really need to blog something. And I just start scouring my brain and I start looking at all these websites and I'm just hoping that God will send me an idea to write a blog post about, because I'm just clueless and I have nothing to do. And at this, like, the last moment, this just act of God and this very interesting story comes across my horizon, or I'm driving around and I'm listening to someone at the Commonwealth Club and something just sparks an idea. And or I'm on Twitter and somebody posts a message like, how do I get Twitter followers? And I say, you know, I could answer that. It is totally ad hoc. It's totally desperation. There's no editorial calendar. There's no plan to it. It's a very challenging thing for me. I have, if anything, you know how some people have attention deficit syndrome? I have attention surplus syndrome. And so what happens is once I get an idea, I can focus on. I can sit for 5 hours straight and write a blog. So that's the nature of how I write. It's scary. Well, it scares me.
You know, maybe that's how you got the inspiration to write, I think it was on your blog, a pretty long article on how to use LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I think they liked it so much they actually posted it on their homepage.
Well, I don't know if I should admit this, because there's nothing but downside for me to tell you what I'm going to tell you. But if I gave you any other answer, I could either tell you I don't want to comment, or I could lie, or I could tell you the truth. So lying crosses the line. I would be a hypocrite, right? So I can't lie. I could tell you no comment, but then I would just look like such a chicken, you know what. So I guess I have to tell you the truth. And the truth is that someone at LinkedIn helped me write that one. So,
you mean you had a ghostwriter guy?
No, that, I'll tell you, of the 1,000 entries in my blog, where I've done interviews, which obviously I'm interviewing somebody, right? So it's his or her words. But of the 1,000 of them, I think maybe that may be the only one that someone helped me write. But it was someone at LinkedIn who truly knew. I said, I was pitched, you know, why don't you write one how to use LinkedIn? And I said, well, I don't really know how to use LinkedIn that well. They said, well, we'll help you. I said, okay. You know, it was one of those nights. It was like I really needed a blog post. It was 4 days. And so, you know, you know, what would you guys have done if you were asked that question? Because, yeah, there is more than one person in the world who knows that, right? So I always feel like if one, obviously the person who helped me write it knows. Probably her boss knows. So that, to give full credit, it's a woman at LinkedIn named Kay Luo. And she basically helped me write that. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the most popular entries I ever wrote. And acted like I wrote. And see, now I'm impugning this, so now you're all wondering, you know, should I go buy that book? Because it was all ghostwritten, but I wrote that book. I swear to you, I wrote that book.
All right, so now,
you know that when I tell you something, it's the truth, because I just did not lie to you, okay? And so, it would have been much more expedient to lie, because now, you know, is anybody on Twitter right now? Okay, no, I mean right now, this second. So you're like tweeting, yeah, a guy admits that he didn't write that post, right? Well, by tomorrow morning, it'll be all over, and, you know, I don't know what. So, you know, so I can't run for vice president.
Well,
big deal.
All right.
I've had a passport for, I don't know, 40 years. I've been to more than Germany. I qualify. You know? My wife is not the president of an association for California to secede from the United States. You know, I think I'm very well qualified. And you know what? I pay for my own clothes. Life is good, man.
So Guy, back to your blog, Guy. So
Sarah Palin is such an easy target. You know the problem is? My prediction here, just to go on the record, within the next 30 days, you're going to read a story that Sarah Palin has sold her book for $5 million. There's going to be the Sarah Palin story, right?
Already done, 7.
Huh?
You got 7, yeah.
It happened already? Oh. You see, I'm so smart that I... And you know what? And she's going to do a book tour, and there are going to be just thousands of old white people showing up for that. And she's going to be on the New York Times bestseller list, and I'm going to puke. I'm going to puke. There is more wisdom in that book's foreword than there is in any book she could write. I promise you. Let me tell you how I really feel.
Well, with that, Guy, let's go back to the to your
$7
blog.
$7 million? Yeah. Who bought it?
I didn't do who. I saw it on a web post.
Oh, my God.
Did a book deal for $7 million, yeah.
That's a lot of clothes, man.
Well, it may be a topic for your next blog.
You think? Yeah, I'm desperate.
So, well,
maybe you should write it.
So about your blog, what blog topic was the one that got the greatest number of negative comments?
Wow. My blog is so universally loved. I'm trying to think of one. Boy. Well, I usually erase the negative comments, so I'll tell you a funny story. I recently went on the USS John Stennis, which is an aircraft carrier, and I spent 24 hours on that, and it was the most interesting experience of my life. You have no concept of how complex an aircraft carrier is. It is basically 5,000 men and women on something that's 3 football fields long. And they can stay on that 5,000, those 5,000 people can be on that 3 football field length thing for, I don't know, 6 months or something without coming to port. And they've got bombs and they've got bullets and nuclear reactors, and there's like a lot of stuff going on there. So I posted a blog entry about my 24 hours, you know, on the Stennis. And it had something like 140 pictures and 5 videos on it. And I took some negativity for that. I took some negativity in the sense like, you know, why did you post so many pictures? It took forever to, you know, read the blog and scroll through the blog. And my answer to that is because, you know, I think that those men and women, whether you agree or disagree with our military policy, those men and women, their asses are on the line You know, they could get killed, much more likely than you and I sitting here will get killed. They could get killed. And so if one parent or one child or one spouse or friend or something saw a picture of one pilot or one steward or one fireman and recognized it in my blog and said, yeah, there's my son on the Stennis, it's worth it. I don't care if people had to download 5 megabytes of pictures to see it. You know, tough. So I got some negativity because of that. I also got some negativity about how I'm glorifying war and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, man, a carrier is a glorifying thing. It is. You should, if you're into hardware, man, try going on a carrier. But that is hardware. And they have these great titles like, you know, one, the guy who runs all the airplanes, his name is Air Boss. And the guy who runs all the ammunition and missiles and bombs, his title is, you know, Ammo Boss or something like that. Gun Boss, I think it's a beautiful thing. I really had fun on that carrier. I really.
All right. So according to this questioner, Alan Kay once stated, the best way to predict the future is to invent it.
Yeah.
Do you envision our current entrepreneurs are doing a good job inventing our future?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I'll tell you something. One thing I decided I would never do, and I think I've done it, is I will never say, well, you know, back when I was an entrepreneur, we really worked hard and we were smart and all. Not like today's entrepreneurs. And I think every generation says that looking backwards. So, you know, we look back and say, oh, the 80s, that was the real time. And someone who's 10 years older than me says, oh, it was the 70s. And someone before that says the 60s, right? And so today's entrepreneurs, you look at it and you say, yeah, they create Facebook out of nothing. They create YouTube out of nothing. They make Google out of nothing. I think that's great. And it's partly because when you're young, you don't know what you don't know. Because when you're my age and you know what you don't know and you know how hard it is to do stuff, you get that much less likely to do stuff. And so I think they're doing a great job. And, yeah, somebody could make a case that, oh, they're doing stupid things like Twitter. You know, what's the sense of Twitter? They're doing stupid things like Facebook and YouTube. But, geez, those things bring great joy to a lot of people, and I think they're very useful. Completely sort of orthogonal to this, the other thing I learned on the Stennis, if you saw the people on the Stennis who are flying $25 million airplanes with, you know, bombs that could end the world, and if you saw the people who are landing those airplanes on the deck, and if you saw the people who are underneath the deck and controlling the cable that catches the plane as they land, and they're all 18 years old, you would have great faith in youth. They really, wow, what a job they do. I was really, you know, and I'm not a hardcore military kind of guy, but I was moved by that trip, I must say. Navy wants me to come back and do another blog because, like, I'm, you know, I dare say I can get, you know, whatever I want. So, yeah, I love that trip. The Air Force hasn't called, the Army hasn't called. I don't, you know.
So, well, let me ask a related question. What's been your most popular blog topic or topics?
Probably my most popular blog topic is a posting I wrote called the 10-20-30 rule of PowerPoint or pitching. So the 10-20-30 rule of PowerPoint is you should use 10 slides, give it in 20 minutes, and use a 30-point font. And I think literally hundreds of thousands of people have read that. So that's been the most popular. It's in the book.
Including someone who wrote a question. So about the 10-20-30 rule, the implication is that there's a lot of great ideas and innovations out there that slip through the cracks because people are unable to communicate about them.
I disagree with that. I think a great product or a great service can overcome a lousy presentation. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe that, you know, they're stuck in the slag heap of PowerPoint presentations was the next Google. And if only they could have pitched it properly it would have been Google. I don't believe that. I think that if you're totally, you know, if you gave me a choice between having a great pitch and a great idea, obviously I would love to have a great pitch about a great idea. But if I could pick one, I'd pick the great idea with totally ineloquent, if that's a word, entrepreneur. Because the pitch is only for raising capital, right? The idea is what stands. And I've seen great pitches with lousy ideas that led to failure. So the 10-20-30 rule is just to increase the probability that you'll get funded so that, you know, you can in fact come to market as soon as possible. But I really don't believe that great ideas died because of lousy PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. I've come to believe that a great idea has a life of its own. And if it was meant to be, it was meant to be.
But great ideas die because of lousy implementation.
Well, absolutely. I'm giving you a lot of before and after in my career. When I started my career, I thought the key to really anything, but in particular entrepreneurship, was the quality of the idea. Right? So if you have a great idea, the rest is easy. You just implement. I've totally reversed myself. Now I believe that good ideas are easy. Implementation is hard. And so so that's why entrepreneurship is so hard. And wow, implementation is just so hard, so hard. And I laugh when people say, you know, please sign my NDA because my idea is so great that if you don't sign an NDA, you might rip it off and give it to somebody else. And I like literally laugh at them. Mm-hmm. And I tell them, well, if you're telling me that the only protection you have on your idea are NDAs and other legal instruments, then your idea is crap anyway. It doesn't matter. And the irony is, the person who is most likely to ask you to sign an NDA to listen to your idea is the person who, in the year 2008, the reason why a venture capitalist never signs an NDA is because at any given moment we're looking at so many deals, it's probably we're looking at the same kind of deal, and if we sign your NDA and fund another, you're going to think we stole it, right? So that's the reason why. So in 2008, people are asking you to sign NDAs, and if you finally explain that and you convince them why you can't sign an NDA, then they say, all right, so guy, you know, I trust you. You're highly visible. I've read your books. You seem like an honest guy. You said you have to be honest, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'll tell you my idea. We're going to sell dog food online. And like that's at the moment I have this out-of-body experience. I say, you're kidding me, right? This is 2008. You want to sell pet food online, and you wanted me to sign a non-disclosure because God knows I might tell somebody, oh, my God, you know, go do this pet foods online because it's patent-pending, curve-jumping, paradigm-shifting. And holy cow. So the more vehement a person is about asking an NDA, generally speaking, the stupider the idea. Anybody got an idea you want to tell me?
So, Guy, I don't remember where it was I read it, but you talked about sharing your ideas with your colleagues, sharing the equity in the company, and really sharing yourself. And that seems to tie closely with the implementation and how people pursue their businesses. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I also think that when people join a company, they are entrusting you with their futures and, you know, in their lives to some extent. And I think that that responsibility, and therefore the reward, should also be shared. And so, I love the concept of options and packages and stuff like that. And I think that people should share the upside because it's upon their backs that you will build the company. And I think that's what makes Silicon Valley great. And I don't see how you could do it any other way. And, well, I guess that, as a CTO of the United States, that's one thing I would, you know, make sure that somehow there's capital gains involved for entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. Because that's what fuels it.
Well, here's a question from an entrepreneur. What would make you or cause you to back a young first-time entrepreneur? And how do you find them?
Well, that question presupposes that, you know, that's the exception. and that, you know, you have to overcome something because you're a young, unproven entrepreneur. And I don't think that's true with Garage. I don't think that's true with Kleiner. I don't think that's true with Sequoia. I do think it's true of many other VCs. If you ask most VCs, what are you looking for in a deal, they will tell you a proven team with a proven technology and a proven business model, right? I mean, that's maybe it's because, you know, it's very difficult to say to an LP, well, our investment thesis is we're going to look for unproven teams with unproven business models and unproven technologies. You know, that's kind of a tough sell to tell CalPERS, right? Mm-hmm. But my observation is if you look at the companies who really have changed the world and created wealth, they were unproven teams with unproven technology in unproven markets. Other than that, they were perfect. So, you know, you look at eBay, you say, wow, you know, you guys want to be VCs? Where's that MBA who has a VC? All right, so you want to be a VC? Two guys come to you and they say, well, we want to create a personal computer. What do you say to that? You say, well, you know, so far I read someplace that the chairman of IBM believes that there's a world market for five computers. Usually that's a university or a government agency. Or if it goes into business, it's a bank. So why would anybody want a personal computer? And then the next day, Pierre Omidyar comes in and he says, yeah, you know, I want to create this perfect market economics where people can sell used HP printers online. And the first thing you'd say to Pierre is, if I'm the buyer, how do I know the printer works? And if I'm the seller, how do I know that I'll get paid? Besides that, there's no problem with eBay, right? And then Larry and Sergey show up and they say, yeah, we want to build a 10th search engine. Forget that there's Inktomi. Forget that there's Yahoo. Forget there's AltaVista. Just put that aside. We want to build a 10th search engine. Yeah, I would invest in that. And then two people come to you and they say, well, we need unlimited bandwidth, unlimited server space, so that people can steal video and upload it. And then every once in a while there'll be some original stuff like we thought, you know, really there is a just huge market potential for videos featuring Mentos and Diet Cokes. We see that as a growth market. So why don't you fund us at YouTube? And so in all those cases, I think there were unproven teams with an unproven technology in an unproven market. Besides that, they were perfect. So that's I think, the beauty of entrepreneurship. Now, the flip side is, okay, so let's say the perfect team comes to you, right? The perfect team, VP of engineering of Microsoft, VP of software development or something at Oracle, VP of sales at Siebel System, this dream team, right? And they're going to start this software company. You think, my God, look at this background. Oracle, Microsoft, Siebel, you know, Salesforce.com. We got all the big names. This is the dream team. As we know with basketball, dream teams don't always win, but, you know, this Olympics they won. But so you look at that, you say, wow, this is a slam dunk. And when you think about it, if you really looked at their resumes, yes, they're the dream team. They all have MBAs. They've all worked for Microsoft. They all work for Oracle or something. And, you know, over the course of their career, Microsoft guy, his biggest fear was antitrust from the Department of Justice. And so at any given moment, his company had $60 billion in cash, and they were making sure they deleted all the emails. You know, that was kind of his strategic focus. And so now you're going to take them out and, oh, by the way, Microsoft had infinite brand awareness. So you take a guy who had infinite brand awareness, $60 billion in the bank, worried about an antitrust lawsuit. That was his competitive threat. And you say, now you got $500,000. You're in a garage. You got zero brand awareness. Build this company. I don't think so. I don't think so.
Well, you touch a subject close to my heart. I've been a technology lender for 17 years, yeah. And I'm the one that passed on eBay at Silicon Valley Bank. So
yeah.
I've let a couple get away.
I passed on Yahoo, so.
So here's a question for you. In your career as a venture capitalist, do you have a story of the one or two that got away? So Yahoo was one?
Well, I'll tell you a great Yahoo story. The great Yahoo story. And I just got a message. Did Jerry Yang resign today? Is that true? Yeah? Well, maybe there's an opening. So this is a perfect day to tell you this story. This is a good story. What time is it? What time is this over? 7 minutes. Okay, this is good. I'll tell you this at the end because I don't like to impugn my intelligence at the beginning of a presentation. About 10 or 15 years ago, whenever Yahoo was just started, Michael Moritz from Sequoia called me up. And he said, Guy, I want you to interview for a position of a company I just funded. And my wife and I were living in San Francisco. We had one child already. She was in beta or pregnant with our second child. So we were living on Union Street, right? We were living on Union Street. And it takes about an hour to get from Union Street to down here. So Moritz says, you know, would you like to interview for the CEO job? And he said, you know, the company's down in Menlo Park. I said, oh, man, Mike, you know, we live on Union Street. We got one kid. One's in the pipe. It's an hour drive each way. And then he said, no, go look at their website. I look at their website. I said, wow, you know, what business model is that? Maybe they're going to sell ads to ARPANET scientists. That's a growth market. And so I said, you know, Mike, it's too far to drive, and I don't see how it can be a business, right? So fast forward till today, the company was Yahoo. So I had the opportunity to interview for basically Tim Kugel's job, to be the first adult at Yahoo. Okay. So let's just say I took the interview. And let's just say I got the job. I probably would have gotten the job, right? Because, you know, it's not like VCs call a whole bunch of candidates, do extensive search. You just, you know, pick up the phone, call one guy, hire him, say, yeah. Okay, so let's say I got the job. And I would have had, I would say, probably 10% of Yahoo vesting over 4 years. You know, first adult, 10%, makes sense. The option strike price would have been 10 cents a share. Would have been able to exercise later for $2,000 a share, right? So I would have made $1,999.90, roughly, per share. And this was before the option backdating thing. You know, back then you didn't have to say, well, the board meeting was on Wednesday and it was 10 cents, but, you know, really on Friday it closed at 6 cents. So why don't we fake the board meeting and say it was on Friday? That way we can give you 6 cents better option strike price. 10 cents, $1,999.90. All right. So now it's a four-year vesting plan. 2 years into vesting, emergency board meeting, right? And they say, you know, Guy, we need someone who can take Yahoo to the next level. Someone who can stand toe-to-toe with Steve Case in Vienna. Someone who can go up to Bellevue, stand toe-to-toe with Steve and Bill, Cupertino, Steve, New York, Barry, Australia, Rupert. We need someone who can stand it to, you know, deal with the media moguls in L.A., you know. So you're not our guy. We're terminating you as of today as a CEO of Yahoo because we need someone who can take Yahoo to the next level. And if that day had come, I would have very calmly said, you know, Mike, I hate to tell you, but this is California. And in California, I, a Japanese-American, I'm a minority. I'm a minority. In fact, I'm an oppressed minority. And furthermore, I hate to tell you, Michael, but the Japanese-American have never forgotten World War II. We're still pissed off about World War II because in World War II, go check someday how many Italians were interned. Not that many. How many Germans were interned? You know, Nazis on our shore. How many were interned? Not that many. Oh, but the Japanese, you took us out of our houses and our farms and our stores, and you stuck us in the high desert, right? We're still pissed off about that. Now you have to do things you have to delete, right? So I'm still pissed off about that, and so you really cannot fire me. And tomorrow morning, there will be a wrongful termination lawsuit on your desk. Then at around noon, turn your TV to CNN, because you'll see 50 invalid, crippled, wheelchair-bound Japanese ladies protesting in front of Yahoo's headquarters about the wrongful termination of one of their own. And he would have said, Guy, time out. You know, now is not the time to be litigious. Let's work this out. Okay, Michael, what do you want to do? And I would have offered that I would go away quietly into the sunset for accelerated vesting. Okay, so I'm here 2 years, give me all 4 years. It's no skin off your butt. Give me 4 years. Okay, so give me 4 years. By my calculation, that response of It's too far to drive, and I don't see how it can be a business. Cost me roughly $2 billion. Now, you know, you're all from Silicon Valley. I don't know why you think it's funny. You're all from Silicon Valley, and even in Silicon Valley, $2 billion here, $2 billion there, it adds up to real money after a while, right? You know? So I've thought about this for roughly 15 years now. Because when you make a mistake of this magnitude, you tend to obsess about it. So I've thought about it and thought about it, and I've come to this conclusion. For the love of my wife, to be there as my four children were growing up, I did the absolute right thing. I picked my family over a career at Yahoo as CEO and making boatloads of money. I did the right thing. That's where you're supposed to clap. Yeah, that's right. There's only one problem. The problem is that explains the first billion. And truly, I tell you from the bottom of my heart, it's the second billion that pisses me off. Because the second billion is the billion that shows that I was stupid. Because I could not understand that the internet was very different than the personal computer curve. Just like Ken Olson couldn't figure out that the personal computer curve was different from the mini computer curve. And just like Western Union couldn't figure out that telephones are different than telegraphs. So that's what upset me, because truly I was a bozo. I didn't understand how much potential the internet had. And furthermore, when I looked at Yahoo back then, it was a directory of websites in the same sense that Alltop is a directory of RSS feeds. So I'm going to get revenge yet. And I just could not see, you know, if you had seen a directory of websites 15 years ago, would a business model have sprung to mind for you? Well, I mean, who could have predicted that Yahoo would become Yahoo Answers, Yahoo Auctions, Yahoo Stores, Yahoo Mail, Flickr, all the good stuff it's become. So, you know, you asked me a question about good deals I passed. Well, that's the mother of all good deals.
Guy.
What?
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where we have time for just one last question.
Okay.
And I'm going to ask you the same question that you asked Steve Wozniak interviewed him on this in this forum.
Yeah.
And as you might recall, he had just published a book.
Yeah.
And you asked him, should your books be available for free on the internet?
Yeah. And you know what? I will tell you that if it were up to me, the PDF of this book would be available on the internet. I would truly do that, because I believe that it would be a very interesting experiment. And the reason I think, don't keep calm. The reason I think is because, in a sense, because that book is a compendium of the best of my writing, particularly from my blog. In a sense, that book already is on the internet. Although, I have to tell you, I thought it would be easy to write that book because I just copy and paste. Man, it was very hard. You have to copy, paste, edit, put together, reorganize. It was a lot of work. Anyway, so I think that people would, you know, download and they would read it and they would read it and they would read about 10 pages and they say, well, this is a really good book, but it's such a pain in the ass to read a PDF on the screen, and I sure as hell don't want to print off 500 pages in a printer and carry that stuff, so why don't I just not be a tight ass and go buy the book, right? And then, you know, Clark Kepler will be happy and everybody's happy. And so, yes, but I didn't get those rights, and, you know, no publisher has the courage to do that. So, you know, yeah, I wish it were. I would, and in a, also, I speak at conferences all the time, and one of the things they use books for like this is they give their audience as a gift, right? So, you know, I just spoke for the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award in Palm Springs, and they gave everybody in the audience a copy of Reality Check, okay? What do you think Ernst & Young is going to do? Say, all right, everybody, as a gift from Ernst & Young, all of you, here is a USB drive with the PDF on it. Knock yourself out. I don't think so. It's a book. So, yes.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.
Well, we hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Guy Kawasaki, Managing Director of Garage Technology Ventures, Tom Verton, the Western Regional Manager at Silicon Valley Bank, our audience here in Santa Clara, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.